Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week I am joined by a music artist who has appeared in not one, but two huge pop acts and forged her successful career as an author and broadcaster beyond the pop music machine in a way very few former pop stars have managed to do.
It's one of the only jobs in our industry where you are judged by not doing that job for the rest of your life. You could have a huge career and that's seen as a failure.
Joining me here, it's the multi-talented Frankie Bridge. Now, just before we dive in, I want to raise a glass to our sponsor, Laurent Perrier, who's added a touch of sparkle to today's episode. As ever, we are sampling their latest release, the Laurent Perrier Heritage, which is more than just a tasteful champagne. In many ways, it's a taste of history. Back in the late 1970s, Laurent Perrier did something bold. While other houses opted for traditional oak barrels, Laurent Perrier began to age their champagnes in stainless steel vats. By controlling fermentation with cool temperatures, they could preserve the wine's freshness and unlock complex aromas. This is one part of what makes every sip of Laurent Perrier so effortlessly refined. So here's to Laurent Perrier Heritage, where freshness and purity come together perfectly. Cheers. Here's to you, Frankie, a Savoy original.
Thanks. Cheers.
Eyes. Did the eyes. Frankie, wonderful to have you here. So I do want to start by asking you a question that we ask every guest on the show. And it's to go back to the beginning of your life. Do you think there's a quality you learnt about yourself early in life that has stayed with you and perhaps shaped everything in your life?
Yeah, I would say I sound like I'm filling out a CV now, but I am a perfectionist and it works for me and against me. But I feel like for me and my job from the age of 12 to now, 35, I think that's been a pro for me because I like to give everything I do 100%. And also, I'd say I'm quite resilient. I'll just keep going, even though I am probably quite self-conscious, self-deprecating, not always that confident, but I love what I do. So I think I'll just always keep pushing through.
So where do you think that came from? Where do you think that perfectionism developed?
I don't know whether a part of it was I loved performing from a young age, and I think I was probably always trying to prove myself in a way, maybe. But look at me, look, I do this, I dance, I sing and all of that. And I suppose even at school, when I was young, at primary school, I didn't like getting things wrong. I don't like getting in trouble. I like to follow the rules. And I don't know whether that's come from my parents or anything like that. I actually think it's just built in me. My parents have a really good work ethic. They both worked when I was growing up, and from a very young age I realized I enjoyed it and actually I wanted to be good at it.
You were 3 years old, I think, when you started doing dance classes.
Yeah.
and you took those very seriously.
I did, yeah. I took it quite seriously from quite a young age.
I'm fascinated. What does that look like, taking a dance class really seriously?
I have a real thing of like, I don't like to be in trouble. I'm not saying I'm perfect or anything like that. Of course, I make mistakes. But I really hated anyone being cross with me or anyone being disappointed in me. So I'd always try and be well behaved and nice and get on with everyone. So I don't think I would have been distracted, but I don't think I would have looked serious. I think I would have had a big smile on my face because I just loved it. Like, there's plenty of videos of me like dancing around the house. We take that on, rolling around on the floor with my microphone that just like, you know, the one that you used to sing into, and it's like hollow. Just putting on shows to my mum and dad, you know, which now I'm a parent, I feel terrible for because they are nothing but boring, let's be honest. They've probably seen it a million times. And I wasn't, you know, my sister was really sporty and really quite outgoing. And I think she had that, whereas I was more, you know, like the choir and like in the orchestra and the uncool stuff.
so the dedication that you put into the performing side of your life, was it really specific to just that, or did you dedicate the same level of passion of work ethic to other aspects, to other subjects, to other hobbies?
Yeah, I think so. I always worked really hard in school. I wasn't the top of my class or anything like that, but I did always try to do my best. Like, I always wanted to do a good job. So with all my schoolwork, I always worked really hard. Sport, I gave it a good go. I joined a football team just because girls didn't really play football then. So I was trying to make a point. Never got picked for a match. But I tried.
You're preaching to the choir over here. I was never very sporty. And I always think the way teams are picked in school is one of the cruelest things that you can go through in school, where it's like, we'll have them, and you're the last kid standing.
Yeah, that was me.
So in terms of that passion and that dedication, at what point did you start to think of dancing and performing as more than just something you enjoy doing? There may be a path here for me as a career.
I think the age I was, you know, things like Pop Idol hadn't happened yet. X Factor wasn't a thing. So to be a pop star as such wasn't really something I would have ever dreamed of. You know, I looked at like West Club 7, Britney at the time, and was like, I aspired to them, but would never have imagined in a million years that that was something that would be possible. Mm. It wasn't really until I was about 9, I was at the same dance school. It was like a local community hall. And my dance teacher asked my parents to come in one day after one of our lessons and just said, have you ever thought about sending Frankie to a stage school? And it was only when she brought it up that then we were like, oh, okay. I knew I loved dancing, but I don't think I'd have known that it could go beyond what I was doing. I didn't really understand properly what that meant. I knew it would mean harder work and probably coming up into London. At that time, it was like you were either in like theatre or an advert. But I remember thinking, yeah, I'm up for that, actually. I didn't know what that would entail, I don't think.
And when you did realise that, no, this could be something here, was there something motivating you to really pursue it? I only ask because, again, for some people, is to maybe escape their childhood. Some people are like, I want more than I had as a kid. And for some people, it's like, I've just had such a great support network around me that's driven me forward. That's helped me get where I am. Where do you think you sit on that scale?
I think I wasn't trying to escape anything. I had like a really nice childhood. I think some of it, when I look back now at this age, I don't really know why, and it's horrible to say it, but like I was popular at school. And I think people liked my clothes. They'd like copy, you know, at the time you could buy your uniform from Woolworths or Matalan, and like they'd copy what cardigan I bought or what shoes I bought, socks. And although sometimes that made me slightly uncomfortable, I enjoyed it. So I probably enjoyed the attention and thought, oh yeah, that's nice. You know, I'll do more of that, get on stage. But I always think it's actually really interesting because a lot of the people in our industry and me as well, we're quite self-conscious. If I walk in a room, I'm not socially that comfortable. It takes quite a lot for me to walk into a room. I feel quite nervous and anxious about it. Yeah, I'll get up on a stage and sing in front of thousands of people. And I always wonder what the psychology is behind that, whether that's I'm trying to prove to myself that I can do it, be scared of something and do it, whether I feel like I have to prove to others that I'm brave enough to do it. And maybe I think I always felt like I had something to keep up.
Well, I think it's time to talk about some of the huge achievements you've had in your career and being in the public eye. I want to know if you have an idea why you've succeeded where others haven't, because there are plenty of pop stars out there for whom being a pop star is it, and that's not the case for you. So do you have an idea of why you have succeeded?
I think a few things. I'm willing to work hard. That's what I get my joy from. And for me, I wasn't done. After S Club Juniors, I was so young. And obviously I had this moment where I was like, God, I'm like 15, 16 and I've had a career already. Like, what do I do for the rest of my life? I thought about that. I didn't just go, oh, okay, that happened and we'll move on to the next thing. I took some time out and got back in touch with people that I'd worked with previously. And so I think I made steps to make sure that I could do something else. And I remember when I was in S Club Juniors and it was finishing, I always knew it would end. I wasn't under this illusion that it would last forever.
Oh, really?
And Simon Fuller called me in to have a conversation about it. And he said, look, people like working with you. And if you keep that up, you'll always have a job. And it really stuck with me. So I like to think that that is a part of it.
So you knew S Club Juniors would end, because again, there is obviously this certainly a stigma that is around young performers being ushered into the pop machine, and whether or not they're going to be looked after, what that's going to do to them. Now, at age 12, I believe, when you joined S Club Juniors, I doubt that's on your mind, but was it a concern of people around you? Was that a question that needed to be addressed at that point?
100%. Obviously, I went for this audition to perform one night at Wembley Arena with S Club 7. Once we got through, Simon Fuller came out and said, actually, we want to turn this into a pop group. And obviously, I needed my parents' permission for that. And for them, they had to really hand me over to a lot of other adults who were basically making the decisions in my life, like what I did every day, when I ate, what I wore, you know, everything. Now I really feel for them, because they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. You know, I would have never have known what I missed out on. But luckily, my mum did ballroom dancing, and my nan didn't allow her to, I think it was a tour or something, didn't allow her to go and do it. So I think that stuck with my mum. So I got away with it. And I'm really grateful that they did. But also, we were so well looked after. And that's not, you know, that's not a piece of fluff that I've been told to say. Like, you know, the rules were so tight, because other than like the Jackson 5 and the Nolan sisters, it wasn't really the done thing. So all the rules were based around musical theatre, which obviously didn't really work for us because that's not what we were doing. And they were very strict with our team. We had the same makeup artist, stylist, everyone from the label. I knew everyone inside out. We had the same driver that would take us to and from work. We had chaperones. We were only allowed certain hours in front of a camera. And at the time, that was quite frustrating as a kid. I was like, oh, I can do more. Like, why do we have to have a chaperone, you know? But the people who we were really close to, they were concerned for our well-being, 100%. I'm in touch with all of those people still now. They still care. If you think they were just as much a part of my upbringing in a way, and I think they really felt that, and they were quite young themselves, you know. They were a massive part of my childhood, and you don't get that now. People don't keep teams around them, you know, for the whole of their career, and especially nowadays, it's a whole different kettle of fish. But I didn't know any different. That was my normal. I think we were really lucky with that.
But the normal part of what a childhood would be had you not been in S Club Juniors, were you still able to see your friends from school? Did you spend time with your parents? I mean, just how intense was the schedule, and how much time did you get to?
I think I still technically did. Like, I started secondary school, I did year 7, and then like year 8, which is second year of secondary school, I was like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off until we became successful. And obviously there were times where I was very tired, but I didn't feel I missed out. I didn't know what my friends were doing. I didn't know if they were at someone's party and I wasn't there. My sister got to do all that stuff, like hanging out in the park with her mates, getting drunk and up to whatever. And actually, I don't think I was that kind of kid anyway. My core group of friends are still my friends from school, or thereabouts, and they are one big part of how I feel I've managed to stay semi-normal and grounded, considering everything I was a part of.
You answered a question I was going to ask when you said I knew it was going to end. You left S Club Juniors and ended up back in quote-unquote normal life. Were you prepared for the sudden change of like being there to being here?
No, I think it was still a shock. But I don't think it was as much of a shock for me as maybe some of the others. I think, one, I had done auditions and never got the part. So I kind of knew that feeling of, like, I don't know, hope, and then just being like, oh, okay, didn't get that one. My parents had always made me aware, and I'd seen plenty of pop groups, you know, in the 90s. They came and they went just as much, you know, like they had this amazing song and then you never heard of them again. So I was very aware of that. And I think I knew I was young, and I knew it wasn't going to last forever. I don't know. I actually, if you watch, we had a TV show which was following us around on CBBC, and the opening credits, I find it painfully, like, embarrassing now. You know, we all pop up with our names and everyone else is like, oh my God, it's just my dream and I've always wanted to do it and I can't believe I'm in a band and I'm a pop star. And I'm like, I'm just doing it for experience, really. What 12-year-old says that? Like, I looked at it and I was like, I'm an actual dick. Like, who says that? And I didn't think I was that kind of kid, but I think maybe I was just very, like, matter of fact about it. I don't know.
I love that.
Yeah, I find it, when I watched it, like, I hadn't seen it forever, and like, someone played it to me and I was like, wow. I don't even know if that was true or not. It's just so bizarre.
I love the fact they put that in the title as well. It's like, what's
all I gave them?
What's the best thing about being in S Club Dune? It's like,
yeah,
wow.
This is just the next job. I know, it's bizarre. Yeah.
So the period where you weren't working in the music industry, because I know you're a fan of Paramore. And
yes.
Did you ever think, do you know what? I think I might form an emo band.
I think not straight away. When it first all ended, first I just really enjoyed just hanging out with my mates. Like, you know, I'd go and meet them in town when they're in a break at college, have lunch with them, and then go back. And it wasn't until they first started all applying for uni that I was like, shit, like, what am I going to do? Like, I got my GCSEs just about. I chose not to do my A-levels because you can take them whenever. I can still remember the conversations like with my friend. I was like, you know what? If I get to be a solo artist, it's good because then I understand how the management works. And if I don't, I could be a music manager and that would be great. Again, I think I just had this, maybe from my parents, of just like this practical brain of this is amazing and you can make it work as much as you want and as you can. But actually also you've always got to have a plan B. So I think that was my plan B at the time. That didn't happen. And I, at that time, had this dream to be a solo artist, but I'd had that opportunity with Simon Fuller after S Club Juniors for a while, and it just didn't work for me. I think I'd come out of S Club Juniors a bit like lost in that I needed to figure out what I liked, what I didn't like, who I really wanted to be. And yeah, then I went through this emo phase. And I think that came from, in S Club Juniors, I wasn't allowed to cut my hair, couldn't colour it. I had to have this very girl next door look. You know, we were just about allowed to wear a bit of mascara and lip balm. I remember the first short skirt I got to wear, like I felt so grown up. And rightly so, like when I look back now, 100%. It didn't feel like a rebellion at the time, but it was that fun stage of just like trying things out. Like I made some new friends that were into that kind of music. They went to festivals, mosh pits, and I got to do all of that stuff. Like dyed my hair yellow, black, had plastic hair extensions in it, wore Converse with holes in with dresses, much to my mum's dismay. You know, like the complete opposite of what I'd been in S Club Juniors. And I feel really lucky that I got to do that. And, you know, I'd get people coming up to me like, oh, not a pop star anymore. You know, like that was quite hurtful.
In that sort of snide way.
Yeah, which I never had that air of, I never felt like I thought I was better than anyone else. It's one of the only jobs in our industry where you are judged by not doing that job for the rest of your life. And I find that really hard because it can be some of the most short-lived jobs. You know, I have friends that bounce from different offices and different jobs and a sister that has tried so many different things and that's not frowned upon yet. You could have a huge career and it not last your lifespan and that's seen as a failure. So I think I found that quite difficult.
But then you're on holiday, your old S Club.
You've done your research.
Thank you.
It's like you've planned this. Thank you. Yeah.
You get a call from Polydor, your old S Club record label. You're on holiday with your friends. And basically, in no uncertain terms, this is an offer to become part of the Saturdays.
Yeah, like you said, I was on like my first friend's holiday in Zante. That was a real eye-opener for me.
Imagine a lot of quad bikes. Did they have a lot of quad bikes?
Yeah. I didn't go on one of those. Right. No. Very sensible Sally.
Death traps,
So many fights. I didn't do it again. But I got this phone call, like you said, on the beach. I don't think I really thought of it as a big deal at the time. I think, I've not really got anything else going on. What's going to happen next? I'll come in for a meeting, you know. I sat in this meeting. I said, we've done a couple of auditions. These are a couple of the girls that we like. This is the plan. It's yours if you want to be in it. And it wasn't until like a year later that we then like released our first single. But I went from having like our driver, Pierre, when we were in S Club Juniors and staying in hotels like the Langham and probably the Savoy at some point, like fancy hotels and that don't want 8 children running around and eating pancakes in the morning at breakfast, to like, oh, you're going to have to get the train in. We'll get you an Addison Lee.
Wait, why is it? So the amount of money being spent on a band at that point...
The industry completely changed. If you think from... But when I was in S Club Juniors, but by the time I was in the Saturdays, streaming had started. The whole industry just completely changed its setup. When I was in S Club Juniors, you didn't make money from singles. It was albums, touring, merchandise. By the time I got in the Saturdays, the 360 deal thing had come about and was a lot harder. So in that way, the record labels didn't have as much money as they did when I was younger. To the point of like sales were completely different. I can remember... S Club Juniors, our first single went to number two and we sold, I'm just going to make it up, like 340,000 singles, say. Saturdays, our first single went to number two and I remember them saying, like, oh my God, it's amazing, you're number two. And then being like, you've sold 5,000 singles. And me being like, shit, that's so bad. Like, what are we going to do? And they were like, no, that's good. That's good. Like, that's what it's like now. And so that was a real, you know, it sounds so spoiled or whatever, but it was a real learning curve for me of like, also then I had to grow up a bit and be like, oh, okay, like I get the train now and I have to look after myself a bit. I haven't got a chaperone anymore. Like it was weird.
And you've got a year between meeting and the band forming and releasing that first single. So how easy is it to form those new relationships? Does it take a certain kind of person, a certain kind of mentality to be thrust into a new group of people? I know you'd known Rochelle before from childhood, but with the rest of the band, is it as simple as just you become fast friends instantly, or is there effort to be put in to go, look, we are going to be doing this for a while, hopefully. We really need to find out how each other work, what makes each other tick and what doesn't work.
I think it's definitely a learning curve, that part, because you go in it and you're all just so excited to be there. I think possibly Rochelle and I, because we've been in S Club Juniors, we maybe had a little bit more cynicism in us of how it would like be, like not in a horrible way, because obviously we had a positive experience, but well, that's not necessarily going to happen, and like this is going to take a while, and they say we're going to be the biggest girl band, but we might not be. And so I suppose there was an element of that. And yeah, you've got five completely different girls thrown together, and there is an element of figuring out each other's personalities. I'd say I was a bit of a tomboy for a while. You know, a lot of my best friends were guys, and learning that different sense of humour, that was a learning curve for me of like banter. Not everyone finds that funny. Some people take that personally, and figuring out each other's emotions. And we were sharing rooms together. We didn't know each other before. We're all from different parts of the country. So it is, it's hard, but it was fun because we all wanted the same goal. It's a lot harder for bands because if you're in a band that plays instruments, you know your role, you know, and I think that's why there's less arguments in those kind of groups and they don't fall out so much, because if you're the drummer, you're at the back. You're the front man, you're at the front, you're the one that everyone's going to look at. You know what your role is. In a pop group, you have to figure that out as you go along. And it might not be the one that you thought you were going to have, or it might not be the one that you wanted. And I think that's where then things can get harder. I think the beginning bit's just exciting.
And are you figuring that out between yourselves, or is it like, to use an obvious example with the Spice Girls, with the Saturdays, obviously it was less defined in a literal sense, but was that something you guys worked out, or did the record company go, Frankie, we feel this is going to be your role in the band?
They don't tell you, but they know what they're doing when they put you together. They're trying to tick as many boxes as they can, appeal to as many people as they can. And actually for me, at the beginning of the Saturdays in S Club Juniors, I'd done a hefty amount of the singing on the records. In the Saturdays, there were people that were more talented than me in that. That was quite difficult at the beginning. I was like, oh, I normally get a lot of the main parts and I'm getting a lot of the backing vocals here. That was a bit of an ego shock for me, I think. But I don't think I found my position until we became successful. And then very quickly realised that, you know, I was the one with the short hair and people copied my hair and again copied my clothes and were more interested in who I was dating, what I was up to, rather than like, is she singing an A in that song, which doesn't happen very often in girl bands. I was really interested in that.
And how did you feel about it? Because, I mean, you brought it up earlier about S Club Juniors. Mm. There was no social media. The Saturdays, obviously, the landscape has changed. I started TV in 2003 and there was no social media. And for me, I certainly felt a lot more exposed and a lot more conscious of everything I did because of the immediate, often quite nasty response you could get.
You know what? It's funny because I feel like we were slowly broken into social media. Like, I remember when we were first in the Saturdays, we're first doing all our like uni tours. Around that time, forums became a thing.
Yep.
So fans could all go on there and talk to each other. And we'd be encouraged to sign in and reply to messages.
Wow.
So I think that was my first like introduction to the really nice parts that come with that.
Mm.
Also, it makes you aware of how popular or unpopular you are within your band. And also there was horrible people on there as well saying horrible things. And it was a shock. Mm. And obviously it just snowballed from there. But I think we were lucky, like I can still remember nearer the end of the Saturdays being on This Morning and then doing a poll on who does the most selfies on Instagram. And I was at the bottom because I just couldn't get my head around the fact that that was socially acceptable now to look like you know that you look good and posting it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because that's, we're British. We don't do that. Do you know what I mean? That was a real weird thing for me. And obviously I'm used to it now. But, you know, I think I was on Strictly in 2014 and I barely posted anything on Instagram. Whereas now social media for that is like just as big as the show now. But it wasn't for me.
You talked about the crazy amount of work you did, starting small with the Saturdays and then and going on. And I think you've mentioned before, like being in a pop band is 365 days a year. It's a full on work schedule. The amount that you're asked to do, and what I find quite crazy is, I think in most careers, most jobs, someone who worked that kind of schedule, work 365 days a year, the amount that you were working, they are doing that in the knowledge that there is career progression, that they are going to be rewarded with the next stage vocationally for that amount of time, which just isn't the case with a band like that, is it?
No. And I also think generally in a lot of creative jobs, it's like you're supposed to be grateful for being there. I think that's a really big thing. And we were all so happy to be there. And I think that gets people take the mickey out of that, really. That's how people get exploited, because people want it so badly and they want to be there. But like you say, with a girl band, there's only so far you can go, and you either end up like a One Direction or a Little Mix or Spice Girls, where they're really successful. It doesn't have to be for a really long period of time, and they make enough money to then not stress too much about what they do next. The Saturdays, we did well, but it wasn't the most successful. So, like you say, yeah, to work that hard and then know that you will have to find something to do afterwards is quite scary. Like, I look at my husband, I'm married to an ex-footballer. He was near the end of the money being what it is in football. His whole career wasn't like that. So he's not like how they are now. But we've probably worked for the same amount of time and he can be clever with his money and not work. Whereas I'm like, yeah, I'm still going. Like, it's like, it's true, but I love it. So I wouldn't really have it any other way.
You mentioned like it being the same in a lot of creative industries. And I've always wondered, in a band like the Saturdays, how much creative input do you actually...
Not very much. No.
Really? So let me phrase it like this then. Were there things that you personally would have liked to have done creatively with the band? Ideas that you had that perhaps it was like, well, that's nice, Frankie, but we're going to do this. We have a team in this office who tell us what is
It wouldn't matter if you didn't like a single. Like, that single was coming out whether you liked it or not. Like, there's a few singles that they don't exist in my head because I didn't like them. And you have to still go on TV and say, buy this single, it's the greatest song ever, and perform it whether you like it or not. And that's fine, because some of them you like and some of them you don't. But I think that is something as I got older that I really missed, because I went from being young and wanting to be a part of that process and being a creative and really enjoying the process of it to then not getting to fulfill that, in only part of it being fulfilled. And I do think that is one thing that I always feel a little bit self-conscious about, is that, like, because I was doing the job from such a young age, I didn't get to go to college and learn all the things that everyone else learns and like, I'm sure we'll come to it in a bit, when I did my first theatre show, like, I felt like a bit of a fraud because I hadn't done all the lessons that everyone else had done. So it swings and roundabouts, but yeah, not as creative as you would like to be, I think.
Right, I think it's time for a top-up. Now, as I drink this Laurent Perrier Heritage, I'm reminded of the joy that comes in every glass. Earlier, I told you about how those stainless steel vats introduced in the 70s shaped a new way of doing things. But the real story is how that innovation translates into the champagne Frankie and I are enjoying now. You see, Bernard de Nonancourt's vision wasn't just about process. It was one step towards the house style we taste in each bottle today. The freshness, elegance, and purity found in every drop. From a crisp first sip to that delicate finish, Laurent Perrier Heritage is all about pleasure. And that is something to celebrate, albeit responsibly. Cheers. The Saturdays have never officially broken up.
No, we're still together.
you are on hiatus. First of all, it's a two-part question. What was it like when you did decide to go on hiatus? And obviously, it would be remiss of me to ask if a reunion was ever going to happen. I think the last thing I heard was the lot of you can't even decide on where to go for a night out, make a date work on your WhatsApp group. But there was never a fallout. You're all still friends.
No, there was never a fallout. And I think I'm always really grateful for that. And what I think with us, what really worked is we were all really aware that we have a life outside of the group. We weren't against, you know, like from the 90s, it was like no one's allowed boyfriends, or to have a baby would have been the end of the world. And for us, everyone knew that people were going to want families and they were going to do other little jobs on the side or whatever, and that was fine. So I think that helped us all to stay friends. I'm not saying we all loved each other all the time, but it's like siblings, like they'd pee you off and then you'd all get over it and it'd be fine. You know, there's no screaming and shouting. So we are lucky in that way. There are no plans. We have had opportunities to reform. Some are more up for it than others. And I flip-flop between the two, because also it happens with S Club Juniors as well. And I'm like, which one am I supposed to pick? I can't do it all.
Unless one supports the other and you're in both.
I don't know. I feel I still miss performing, and I still, like, you know, if I go and watch a live show, like, I can't help but be like, oh, they've just done this backstage and this is how their quick change would have gone. And like, and I miss that feeling and I would love to do it. But also I'm like, I know I'm not old, but if you have to humour me, I started when I was 12. Like, I feel a bit old and I feel a bit like that. I've done it. I've done it twice and I got to do it successfully. And it's not quite who I am anymore, you know?
Well, that's a good time to talk about who you are now. Because between your writing and your appearances on TV, you seem to be doing, and I could be wrong, but to me, you seem to be doing your most authentic work yet. The stuff that is really you. So with all the experience and knowledge that you have, what do you think it takes to be original?
It's actually really difficult to be original, especially when you have been burnt by newspapers or people. To become original, you have to grow a thicker skin. And I think I have done that over time. And I think you have to learn about yourself before you can be original in the public eye.
And do you think part of that is the fact that you, after leaving the Saturdays, you've struck out on your own, which must be quite an interesting, unique, maybe even challenging experience, because for the first time you were doing things without people alongside you who are literally going through exactly the same experience as you.
Yeah, it was really lonely at first, like even down to coming and staying in a hotel. Like, I go into my room and I'm like, okay, I love it now. But at first I was like, this is awful. And the pressure's on you. Like, if you asked me a question, I didn't know the answer, I could be like, what do you think, Rochelle? Like, you could pass stuff off. Now it is fully on me. And at first I did find it really strange and really difficult. But now I couldn't imagine having to take into account other people's opinions or worries on things. And
do you think you become more fearless?
I think parts of me have become more fearless. I still have that people pleaser in me. I still have that, like, I don't like it if I feel like someone doesn't like me or if I haven't done a job well enough or whatever. But I am confident in myself in that I know I've done my best. Whereas I think when you're in a band, you're made to feel disposable. Now I know if I am successful, it's because I've worked hard. And if I fail, it's because I've done something wrong or whatever reason. When you're in a pop group, you're very made to feel like you could be replaced tomorrow. And I think now I realise that's not true. I think Sugar Babes are literally the only band that have managed it. Like everyone else, someone leaves, the band very quickly closes down or whatever. And I wish I realised that at the time, even for all of us, not just for me personally, so that I could turn around and say to the girls, like, come on, don't be so self-conscious. Like, we can stand up for ourselves here. We can say this, we can say that. I think it's a shame. I think that comes with age and being in the industry for a while. Yeah, I don't think it's as common now. I think artists are a bit more... I don't know, maybe I'm out of touch, but I feel like they're slightly more in control of what happens because of social media and stuff like that.
Does it prevent you from enjoying your time in a band that, like the Saturdays, as much as you could because of that? Is there always that idea that, to use your example of being replaceable, does that prevent you from just really embracing the moment and embracing the fun of this?
Yeah, I didn't. Like, I look back now and I look back and I'm like, I can't really remember performing at Wembley Arena. I can't remember those feelings and those moments. I actually remember more from S Club Juniors, weirdly. But I think because I was younger and I was just in the moment. Whereas when I was in the Saturdays, I was already aware that it could end and what that's like when that happens. I was aware what people thought of me. I was 18, 19. I was more self-aware. I didn't get to just soak it up and enjoy it. And I look back now and I have loads of great memories. But sometimes I think, oh, I wish I just really went for it. Like when I did Strictly, I look back and all I can see is insecurity of not wanting to look like I thought I was good. Like, who cares, really? Like, who cares if anyone thought I was great at dancing or not? But at the time, like, I didn't want to come across as a show-off or anything. And I'd love to go back and not have those feelings.
I honestly wonder if that's possible. I think everyone in the moment, it's a natural state to be just very concerned about that moment and how you are being perceived. And we all look back and go, God, I wish I'd been more present. I think what's interesting is... For example, to talk about some of your writing, your first book in 2020, Open, Why Asking for Help Can Save Your Life. And now, I read that, and that title alone seems to speak volumes. Did it feel writing that you were able to vocalise the struggles that you were having that you just simply were not able to say out loud when you were in the Saturdays because of the nature of being in a band like that, the schedule, the need to be, in inverted commas, on all the time?
Yeah, I think times have changed so much now. When I see someone like Lewis Capaldi cancel a tour because his mental health is, and everyone supporting him on that, and a label supporting him on that. For me, I was a real deep thinker already, a real worrier. That just got worse in the band because I was so self-aware, always trying to be perfect, always wondering what's next. And when I was hospitalised for my depression, that was unheard of. And we were just about to do a tour, and me being hospitalised for mental health, our insurance wouldn't have been covered. I'd have been letting so many people down. A lot of money would have gone amiss. It was like this really big thing, which I'm sure it still is now, but it just wasn't a thing. And it was like, oh, she's in hospital because she's anorexic or she's got an addiction. And that was like the only two things that anyone in the public eye could possibly have wrong with them. So for me, it was really important to come out and say, actually, it's depression, anxiety. Anyone can have it. And weirdly, like, I think Stephen Fry was like the only other person that had ever spoken about his mental health at that point. Funny group to be in. But I did that and then I parked it. It was like, I addressed it. You know, I have depression, anxiety. This is what it is. But now I go back into being in a girl band, no opinion, no talk of medication, therapy, nothing. Everything's fine now. And so for me to write the book Open was, I didn't have a ghostwriter because I felt like it was too personal. It was my opportunity to take that back and say all the things that I couldn't say at the time, I think.
And to take the subject matter out, not because it's not important and relevant, but because as a creative exercise, writing a book yourself from start to finish, that must feel like just such an achievement, because writing a book is devilishly hard.
Yeah, and I'm really bad at spelling, so it's amazing, really. I made that joke to some parents at school and none of them found that funny. I was like, don't worry, guys, the kids will be fine. I'm really rubbish at spelling and I've had a best-selling book. And they were all just like, huh. For me, the passion for it was that I got to work on something from the ground up, and it was all me, which, like I said, in a band, you do not get to do that. So it was like from picking the cover, from writing it all, how we were going to promote it, everything I was a part of. And like I said, like that then meant I had no one else to blame. I had no one I could be like, oh, it didn't work because of this or whatever. And so that is one of my like proudest achievements of like, it, regardless of like whether everyone loves it or not, I'm like, that's mine. I did that.
And then your follow-up book, Grow, which focuses on your experience of being a mother. How did becoming a mum change your career perspective? Now, I ask this because I don't have kids. And to me, that's a huge decision to make.
Like, yeah, I think I was 24, so I was very young when I got married and had kids. And I think for me, starting my career at such a young age, I looked at other successful people and felt that they had these huge careers and often not much else outside of that, and I didn't want to be that person. Having a family was really important to me, and for me, I felt like I'd done it, you know, like when I was performing in the last few times with the Saturdays, I was thinking about what I was going to have for lunch rather than like being in the moment and really enjoying it. And I think when you get to that point, you realize that you're done. And I fully went into having kids thinking that I wouldn't work. That didn't happen.
No, of course.
It wasn't for me. And I really, I get really envious of mothers who that is enough for them, because that feels like a slight failure for me in that it's not fully enough and I thought it would be. But I love what I do. It's such a big part of me and I don't know any different. So it was a big decision and it does affect your career. And before I had kids, I would look at really successful mothers, look at them and think, well, you go to work, you don't think about your kids. You go out for a night out, you don't think about them, they're fine. And actually, for me, the biggest shock was, which is really obvious, is that they are always on your mind. You know, the mum guilt that I have is constant. And I bend over backwards, doesn't matter how tired I am, to try and do everything, again, 100%. And obviously that's unrealistic. So you're always, if you are like that, you're always going to feel like you're failing at something. And all mothers I know feel that way. But there are times when I think, oh, would I have started acting earlier? Would I have moved to a different country and done something different? Would I have had a slightly different career had I have not had my kids? But equally, I'm like, I did it.
Well, yeah, and you're as busy as ever. Your profile's as big as it's ever been. Like, let's take, for example, Loose Women. You became you were a guest panelist in 2020, now a regular panelist. The reception from the Loose Women audience has been entirely positive about your candid answers and your honesty on the show. Is it recorded live?
Yeah.
It is recorded live.
So I did it this morning, yeah.
So, for example, when I'm presenting, obviously, you know, I've got a script, I've got an idea what I'm going to say. Loose Women, it's live. You are required to, you know, often think...
Have an opinion, yeah.
Have an opinion, exactly. Like, how hyper-aware do you have to be in the moment of what you're saying and those opinions that you're airing to be able to both be honest but not say something contentious?
Yeah, it is a fear of mine. I think definitely nowadays, like, the cancel culture is strong. We have an hour's meeting in the morning to go through the subjects and we have very candid conversations in that room. I love it.
I think that should be the show.
Yeah, it really should. None of us would have a job probably. But, you know, that's the fun of it. And then we come out and obviously we've only got an hour to do a whole show. So it is whittled down slightly, but it is all honest answers and things. And when I first started, I was really, really nervous. And actually, I'd been asked to be a Loose Woman, but I didn't feel like I had an opinion. I felt like I wasn't confident to have one, so I didn't want to do the show. And it wasn't until I wrote my book and had more of an opinion, was more honest, that I felt like I could do it. But there's a safety with the women Like, we do genuinely, as much as the press likes to pit us together because we're women, boring, we do look out for each other and we will disagree with each other. And then in the break, everyone's fine. You know, we're not all still arguing about it afterwards. And I actually love it. I didn't realise how much I love a debate. I don't care if someone doesn't agree with me or if I don't agree with them. I find it so interesting why they feel the way they do and why I feel how I do. And actually, I've got in trouble publicly for the most bizarre things. I can talk about women's rights and Black Lives Matter and things that I would be nervous to talk about and be fine. And yet I talk about how wedding cakes are expensive and the whole cake industry wants to take me down and get me cancelled.
Is this an actual example?
A genuine. Wow. Like a letter into the show. Mm. You know, she needs to be sacked. They wanted to come in for a meeting. Like, yeah.
So I shouldn't laugh, but that's insane.
I know.
Wow.
Also true.
Yeah, wedding cakes are expensive because you only buy one, in theory, once. Yeah. So they can be.
And that weekend I went to my best friend's wedding and my agent was like, please, whatever you do, do not post a picture of you next to the wedding cake. And I was like, you know what? I won't, because there isn't one, because it was too expensive. So it's things like that I get in trouble for, or like, actually, it's been a real learning curve for me, in that it's the things that you think are okay and safe to talk about that normally aren't, and that you just can't win.
Do you think sort of almost being part of that panel on Loose Women and having those opinions and going through the idea that some people might disagree with you, might not like what you have to say, does it make you stronger?
I think so. And it makes me more confident to talk just in general in social situations, to have an opinion. I'm quite like a level-headed person. I can see most things from both sides. So that is naturally who I am. But it doesn't scare me as much. Like, I have a group of friends, we go out for dinners. They always have a debate about something. I normally spend the whole time laughing at them because I think it's so funny. They can be so angry about something. It's not much that makes me that angry. But I'm not scared of it anymore. But I think I have realized, like, not everyone's going to like me and they're not going to agree with me. And that's fine. And that's the whole point of the show. I don't agree with everyone on the panel. Maybe not everyone on the panel likes me. Put a group of people in a room, you probably won't like all of them. And I've had to learn to laugh at it. I actually find now if I post a picture of me and my friends and someone says something about a friend, or if someone says something about my kids or my husband, that hurts. If they say something about me, I'm just like, oh, whatever.
You mentioned this already. You appeared on stage in the hugely successful play 222, A Ghost Story, in 2023. You said you felt like you had imposter syndrome going onto that stage. What does it feel like? Because I think for a lot of people, it'd be like, well, you've taken the stage at Wembley. How scary can it be walking onto the stage at a theatre?
Oh, it's so different. So far out of my comfort zone. First of all, when you're at Wembley Arena, you cannot see one human being and they are one big noise. And I have a role that all five of us are playing and we're all playing the same one. We're all doing the same dance routine, singing the same song. When you're acting, for me, it's funny, when you hear from most actors, they love it because they get to play someone else. I find that really exposing because I feel like I'm making those choices and they might be choices that other people don't agree with, of what that character would do or how they'd react. So I feel the pressure more in that. And when you're in a theatre and there's no music and you're just speaking, it's so quiet. And if no one laughs at the thing that's meant to be funny, that's deafening. And you hear everything. So I found it really exposing, but so exhilarating. And it's a really different kind of exhilaration from standing at the end of a performance of a song and a dance and whatever, like, and people standing up and clapping for you. At first, I was a bit like, oh, I don't know if I get anything from this. Like, after the first night, I was a bit like, don't know if this is doing it for me. And then as it went on and the more confident I got, I was like, oh, okay, no, I like this feeling. But I had 2 weeks to learn a whole script, 2 weeks to learn how a play even works in the West End, to go into a cast of people that have already been doing the play for months together and to be slotted in. And it's quite a fast-paced show and I'm still trying to remember my lines as well as keep up and act and remember that you only go on stage when the green light's on and, you know, X, Y, Z, you know. But I was like, God, I work well under pressure. That's like my sweet spot.
And what changed in that evolution from that first time of going, oh, I don't know if I love this, to loving it? What was the thing that changed for you?
I think I just got more comfortable with it. I think in the first few weeks, I was so in my head because I was like, shit, I dropped that line. Oh, did someone else have to pick up for me? Oh, I didn't really, that bit wasn't emotional enough. I was overthinking it all the time. And I was still having to, I had my own map backstage of how the play went because I did a lot of the same actions. And for me, obviously, I remember things by dance routine of where they are in songs and where I am on stage. So for me, being on stage became like a dance routine. And that's what helped me. When I pick up this glass, I say this line and da da da. So I had this map backstage and I was still having to run off and look at things like that. And I think once I'd fully learnt it and felt fully comfortable, then I could end a show and go, oh, that was fun.
I mean, let's do a pie in the sky situation. So if Marvel rang tomorrow and went, look, we want you to be in the new Avengers movie, what's your answer?
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love to do a role where I have to learn other stuff, you know, like fight scenes and how to use weapons and like all those stuff that like as an actor you get to learn all these things on top. Or like a Bridgerton, because I love the costumes. And when I was a kid, I was obsessed with Victorian costumes. I always used to try and make them. So to be able to like...
You used to try and make Victorian
costumes?
Yeah, out of
old curtains.
How'd it go?
Really badly. Yeah, not great. Haven't got the structure.
Oh, I feel you need to be in a Bridgerton just to make that moment of pulling down some curtains to make a costume
like
worthwhile.
I'm Cinderella or something, yeah. No, who is it? Yeah, it's Cinderella. Yeah, that'll be me.
Frankie, it's almost the end of the interview, but before I let you go, we do have three quick-fire questions for you to answer. Okay. You don't have to be that quick, but I call them quick-fire questions. First of all, we have just made our way through a tiny portion of your achievements today. But of all your achievements, what are you truly most proud of?
The play, Ghost Story. Yeah, it was just so far out of my comfort zone. And my kids came to watch, and being on a stage and then being in the audience was like a really big deal because all of my career happened before my kids. So they don't really know how I got to where I am. So it was really nice to see that.
That's amazing. Did they love it?
They did, yeah. And they had so many questions. And obviously I'd told them the ins and outs of it because I didn't want them to be scared. And just hearing them like telling their friends about it and stuff like that. Like I was like, oh God, I'm cool for like 5 minutes. Because I'm like, their dad used to be a footballer. That's all they care about. I am not noteworthy other than that.
Tell me the most valuable skill you've ever learned.
I feel like probably when I was younger, although I resented it at the time, playing piano. Because I think it helped me musically. I can't play anymore. I play piano, cello and guitar. And I can roughly read music, which is really frustrating because I used to be able to read it fully. But I think it's really helped me, like, musicality-wise throughout my life.
And our final question. Can you give one piece of advice to someone who would like to follow in your footsteps?
Oh, God. Don't. No. I would say, oh God, it's so different now. I don't know how you get into the industry now.
It's weird, isn't it? I often get asked, people go, oh, how can I do what you do? I go, I have no idea.
Know.
When I started, YouTube wasn't a thing. I'm pretty sure that's a way in now.
Yeah. I think you've got to be willing to work hard and you've got to be willing to take the knockbacks. If it's something that you really want to do, then you just have to keep pushing through and hope for the best.
We kind of end where we began then with your work ethic and that work ethic that's seen you sitting here today. Frankie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking
to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Oh, cheers.
Cheers once more. A huge thank you to our producer, Lauren Armstrong-Carter at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Laurent Perrier, and of course, to the wonderful Frankie Bridge. Thank you, Frankie. We'll be opening the Savoy's Little Black Book again soon to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye for now.